the MPM Radio Network, home of LouisvillePolitics.com. I tell you, we're just going to get right into it because, lo and behold, miracle of all miracles, my good friend and co-host, Mr. Ed Martin, is with us tonight. How are you, sir?
Yeah, with you for the time being. Actually, I apologize for last night that you saw my text messages. They were colorful. And all of a sudden I realized, oh no, because I was in Pennsylvania on business, and now I'm finishing that up. And I completely forgot. But, no, I had somebody buying me dinner, so sorry, you lose.
So the free dinner is what got you to Pennsylvania. Otherwise, you would have sent Obama to look after the business that he built, right?
It would take a lot more than Pennsylvania, a lot more than to get me to Pennsylvania. But, business, you got to call on customers. And I did.
I thought that was Obama's job.
On this trip, I drove the D.C. Beltway, and they went to Appomattox Courthouse. I thought, well, I'm not going to stop off and check stuff out, but literally the road I was on was right there. I mean, it was 100 yards off the road. And I'm like, oh, no way. doing that. And the World War II D-Day Memorial happened to be in the town that I went to in Bedford, Virginia. So I was like, 90% business, but this part of the country is rich. Once you get to within the earshot of the ocean, there's just a lot of history there. It was interesting.
Well, there should be a lot of history there. Look at where it's at, man. That's where we started. So, speaking of history, we've got a neat little thing going on. The Republicans are set to do a historic thing. I don't know. I guess you've been out of touch for a while, but check this out. David Adams is reporting. Everybody knows who David Adams is. He's the one that ran Ron Paul's campaign. And David Adams is a friend of the show, and he calls in from time to time. We have him as a guest. But he runs the Kentucky Progress and a couple other think tanks right now. But from what I gather, Mitch McConnell is tired of the Tea Party people, and he's scared to death of them. So he is working to eliminate conservative primary challengers to the favored status quo candidates. What he's going to do is he's trying to get the Republican State Executive Committee, which he controls, to get into the endorsement game for Republican primary candidates. What do you think about that?
Well, like so many other things you do in life, it could go either way. I think there's a level of arrogance there. No mystery that I don't think the world of Mitch McConnell and Biden, but when you get to this point, you get to the red stars of the Ken Mulman theme and other stuff. And it's like, guys, in the Ron Paul, the exclusionary tactics of the Republican National Convention with the Ron Paul people, and they're so desperate to do this power consolidation, this consolidation, wrap it up with a neat little bow on top of it, that they're bucking for a fight, and they're going to get it. I've said that many times. They're going to fight the Tea Party people. And the thing is the Tea Party people and the constitutionals and the third parties and the independents, they don't have to work against you. All they have to do is not vote for you, and you lose. And I think they just don't get that. They're still wanting to all ride the bus with their celebrity buddies and everything, and just they all want to be players, but they don't want to put their names on the ballot. They want to control it from behind the scenes, like I guess Steve Robertson. Like, dude, if you want change and you want to run yourself, but like I say, it could go either way. It could work wonderfully, and they could end up with the most dull, milquetoast party line towing candidates you ever got. They would never buck the status quo, and they'll get their plows clean come election time. Or they can, embrace the messy process that it is. Be big boys if they lose. Be big boys if they win.
What makes it so damn interesting, though, is, I mean, Mitch McConnell should have a decent opponent in the next election. But, he controls the Kentucky Executive Committee. He runs it. Is there any other proof that we need that Mitch McConnell is a Republican, obstructionist? Because, here he is. He wants to get into the game of endorsing primary candidates and stuff. so that he can force the election. And that's not the goal of the Republican Party or any party. The parties are supposed to let the primaries play themselves out and stay out of the endorsement game. That way everybody supposedly, and I say supposedly because we know what goes on behind the scenes, but supposedly it levels the playing field for the primary candidates. What they're trying to do is ignore that, is ignore history here, and they're trying to set the stage for who they want to put in office and install in office, I should say. And that really hurts all of us. I mean, are the Republicans so stupid and ass backwards under Mitch McConnell that they're literally willing to implode to keep from having responsibility or to keep from gaining power?
Well, like I say, it's a control thing. I'm sure if you dig down, you're going to find that part of it had to do with people like Todd Akin, you know, who was a Tea Party kind of candidate in Missouri who came out with the the legal abortion comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Murdoch, who was in Indiana, who came out with, and both guys should have won, but they both got beat pretty nicely, and they were embarrassing. And I think the party just wants to control it. They want to pick, they want to pick nits, little nits and little niches that are boring and don't ever say anything controversial, don't ever color outside the lines, and they're just trying to control it. And I guess they think, look, if we don't put a candidate up that stirs the pot any, like Rand Paul, if there's nobody with any passion, nobody with any imagination, and they just get up and you can mold them like little Christmas cookies and stuff, if they think they're going to win. And if they win, they absolutely control the person like a puppet when they get in. And, It could work, but they already do that. It could backfire so horribly, and my money says it would backfire horribly. Because,
well, as far as I'm concerned, the Republican Party is backfiring horribly as we speak. When you've got Mitch McConnell, who essentially cost the presidency for the Republicans in this election, I firmly believe that. He spent the last 2 years saying that his job in the Senate was to do nothing more than defeat Barack Obama. It's hard to overcome something like that if you're an independent or somebody outside the two-party system or a Democrat who's got conservative leanings. It's hard to overcome that obstruction mindset. And then you look at John Boehner, and yes, folks, I know his name is Boehner. I always call him Boehner, so don't give me the calls on it. But you look at Boehner, and Boehner is basically been playing the same game in the House. I mean, it's like the Republicans are scared to leave, don't want the responsibility of leadership, all to keep some sort of a, hidden cookie for a select few, just for leadership. Boehner, yeah. I mean, he got rid of four people already on the committees in the House, and he's slapping people around right now trying to get them to jump back into shape. What does that say to we, the American public?
Well, it says the same thing. It's happening on all levels. We saw it on the Jefferson County level. We've seen it on the state level. They're more into consolidating their power and wrapping things up nice and neat, and not having any challenges. Which, that's an anathema to democracy anyway. I mean, it's supposed to be a messy process. It's fun, If you got any thick skin at all, the messiness is the fun part. People don't go for that. They don't like the stuffed shirts. They don't like literally the rich old white guys who don't break the rules kind of guys. It's like, hey, we all like rule breakers. They're fun, need some rule breakers because right now abiding by the rules and doing the same old crap over and over sure as hell isn't working for the country.
Well, we talk about this going on at federal level. We also have the same problem at state level, local level, everywhere. And it's interesting to me because, these candidates continue to get screwed over by the party itself. And then, of course, you have some candidates like Brian Simpson here locally in the state of Kentucky. He does stuff on his own that was just idiotic. I want to mention this story real quick while you're still live in case we lose you because I know you're going to want to weigh in on it. But Brian Simpson, former state legislative candidate for District 46, took on powerful Democrat Larry Clark in that district, was found guilty of illegally coordinating with a bunch of unions. The unions, of course, got off the hook. But they've got a group called the Truth from American Workers, which is union funded. Anyway, the Kentucky Registry of Election Finance, we talked about this story a few months ago. Brian probably should have went to jail, and apparently they've reached an agreement where he won't go to jail. Simpson has agreed to pay a $1,000 fine, and the Truth from American Workers PAC agreed to pay $5,000. And this all stems from Simpson coordinating with these guys and having them spend $170,000 during his election. And he coordinated with these guys with film and everything else. He allowed them to videotape him and talked with them and pose. And all this stuff is illegal. But we got one more example of somebody who's not held accountable to that. And what's ironic here is I actually caught the story while I was perusing Facebook earlier this morning. I was going through my Louisville politics on Facebook and checking mail and things like that. It was actually sent to me by Larry Clark, his opponent, who was probably one of the most corrupt individuals in the House as we speak. And he's telling the whole world that Simpson was corrupt. You know, what does that say when we can't even get anything on that? I mean, we can't even get accountability for that, which tells me that, you know, that the politics rule at every level.
Yeah, well, I think there is a measure of accountability. I mean, they're paying their fines. Now, the unions, to be honest, as I've said before, they knew flat out, you know, this is what they do. They really, really knew. Now, as far as Simpson, I mean, he I'm sure he knew. But, you know, he could have fallen in, because that was his first run, could have fallen into the category of, yeah, okay, wink, wink, nod, nod, trust us on this, everybody does it. I don't know. You're right. It was illegal. They're going to pay their fines and hopefully move forward. And enough people have seen this, and hopefully it won't happen again. But I mean, I think one of the reasons, if the fines were kind of light actually, is because he didn't win. I mean, had he won, had more money been in play, I think, you know, that shouldn't factor into the KREF, but I'm sure it does.
Had he won, he'd be in jail. There's no doubt in my mind about that. Had he won, the Democrats would have made sure that he went to jail for this instead of just fining him. You know, but the interesting thing for me,
Jack Conley would have prosecuted that one.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it.
Prosecuted that one.
You could bet on it. Greg Stumbo would have been involved. Larry Clark has all kinds of political power. And he would have just called in some favors. They'd have took Simpson to court. They would have put him in jail. I mean, he knowingly violated the law. And this is a knowing thing. And here's the thing that always gets me, because anytime the KREF finds probable cause that there was illegal activity, they always come back and try to make this an unknowing violation. You know, now Simpson is small potatoes when you count to people like, Jim King, you know, and folks like that. Simpson is small potatoes, but at the same time, you know, he flat out lied during his testimony, then came back later and told the truth once he got caught lying. The intermediary and all this, well, the unions involved were the UFCW union, the Teamsters, the Jefferson County Teachers Association, and United Mine Workers of America. Those are the guys behind Truth from American Workers. Those are the unions involved. And these union leadership, Chris Sanders at the UFCW, you can get into the teachers, Brent McKim at the Jefferson County Teachers Association. I know he was involved. You know, these guys knew it was wrong and did it anyway, and that's where that wink, wink, nod, nod comes in. And that's the problem for me, is because they don't get held accountable. Now, Simpson is held accountable, obviously, as a candidate, but these other guys are not held accountable, no more than David Toborowski, who was the go-between between the JCTA and Brian Simpson. He's the one that set all this up. And David Toborowski was not held accountable. Now, everybody knows out here in the South End anyway who Toborowski is. He's Dan Sein's right-hand man. But this is the kind of illegal stuff that goes on. But the people that are being punished are not necessarily the guys who are doing it, like Brent McKim, like Chris Sanders, like a few others. Why is it that we cannot get union leadership accountable? And there's a reason I'm bringing up unions, and we'll talk about that in a second. But why is it that we can't get them accountable, Ed?
Oh, well, they're still, even in spite of this particular election, they're still buddy-buddy with the Democrat machine, and that includes Conway, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the speaker of the House, you name it. They're knee-deep in Frankfurt, so that's not going to happen.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, Simpson originally denied he was being videotaped, and then said, and then said later, well, okay, I knew it. I mean, you know, we were trying to make a nice little thing here. You know, so, I mean, he lied, came back, retracted, you know, so give him a little bit of credit, I guess. I mean, when they threatened him with jail, I'm sure that's when he changed his story. But, you know, we don't have that same situation with Brent McKim at the JCTA or Chris Sanders at the USCW, nor the Teamsters or the United Mine Workers of America. This is the problem for me. The unions have gotten to the point where the politicians are scared to hold them accountable. And that is concerning to me because as we move forward, well, I'll tell you what, let's take a break real quick before we get into that because we're going to get into what's going on in Michigan right now with Right to Work. For you guys on the in the queue right now, hit the little number one on your dial pad. We'll be more than happy to get you on air. For you guys who are listening all across the land through Stitcher Radio or iTunes or live right here at BTR, phone numbers 858-683-1326 or 502-805-0334. And for you guys who are on AOL, listen to any of that stuff online, you can IM me direct at myviewmatters@AOL.com, and we'd be more than happy to discuss anything with you there. We'll be right back, folks. You got Ed Springsteen on the MVM Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Everybody, gather around. I'm here to give you anything you like. You want free college, energy, mortgages, whatever you like. You have come to the right place. Why? I'll tell you why. Who can take your money?
Who can take your money?
With a twinkle in their eye.
A twinkle in their eye.
Take it all away and give it to some other guy. The government.
The government.
The government can.
The government can.
And who can tax the sunrise?
Who can tax the sunrise?
Who can tax the trees?
Who can tax the trees?
Let you run a business and collect up all the fees. The government.
Bingo, yep, bingo. Sunshine Bingo Center at the corner of Outer Loop and Old Shep. You can go to sunshinebingocenter.org, but they've got bingo just about every night of the week. You can play for as little as $3 in some sessions. You know, get a chance to win, you know, 100, even a couple, even 1,000 if you get the coveralls. So check out Sunshine Bingo Center, our good friends over there at the corner of Outer Loop and Old Shep, up in the Peddler's Mall, and tell them we sent you out there. So, you know, Ed, we continue going on and on and on, you know, with everything going on. This story just in, before we move on with this labor stuff, this story just in, apparently John Boehner was given a counteroffer by Barack Obama yesterday. The counteroffer was basically that it was going to be a $1.4 trillion additional revenue instead of $1.6. So the president came down $200 billion less than what he first proposed for the budget. Boehner has now made another counteroffer today, actually just a couple of hours ago. But, of course, we have no details on that yesterday. From what I understand, Boehner and President Obama have been speaking on the phone. So, you know, I guess we'll get some more details on that probably sometime tomorrow afternoon. So hopefully we'll have those in time for tomorrow night's show. But, you know, this whole fiscal cliff thing, Ed, I mean, I'm almost puzzled by this. You know, Paul Hollinger was on here last night for a few minutes, and he mentioned the fact that he kind of thinks that this may be intentional. What's going on right now may be intentional to force a correction in our money. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, how often do I say politics is theater? And Boehner and Barack, they're going back and forth. And, you know, truthfully, when you're negotiating, there's no need to do it so damn public. So they're like, I'm sending a counteroffer, you know, theater. You know, I'm sending another offer, theater. You know? It's like, we'll give you the details after, you know, well, they probably don't have the details. Whatever, we'll give you the details after it's accepted or refused. Theater. Yeah, I think it's just that they have to give the impression that they're trying to make it work, you know. And they're just throwing huge numbers around, and they don't have any details. So, you know, it's like, oh, we'll be $1.4 trillion. It's like, really? Okay, what are you cutting? You know, what got cut in that two-thirds? Well, we'll work those details out later. It's like theater, you know. There are no specifics. It's theater. So that's all they're doing. So if we do go over the fiscal cliff, they can say, well, we tried.
Right.
You know, the other side just didn't play ball, and they both say the same damn thing, so.
That's, well, what's interesting,
that's all it is in my mind, because they've had the better part of a year to do it.
Well, what's interesting to me is, I mean, you know, for one thing, most of the stuff that Boehner is talking about now is the same stuff that Obama had previously agreed to prior to the election. Okay, and now all of a sudden President Obama wants to double down. And, you know, we expect that. He's a lame duck president. He's going to play hardball. We expect that. But, you know, nobody is calling the president on what he has already previously agreed that he would consider, you know, as of just 2 years ago. So I'm having a problem with that. And then when we look, at the comparisons on these on the proposals, this is as of yesterday. Of course, we don't know what Boehner sent over to the president today, but they're really not that different. You know, the biggest thing that continues to come up is the Bush tax cuts. All right. So what the Republicans want to do is they want to eliminate mortgage and charity deductions, which is going to raise $80 billion. They don't want to extend for incomes above $250,000. But they both agree on extending the Bush tax cuts for anybody earning below $250,000. All right. And that's actually misleading, too, because if you look at the president's proposal, it's actually about $300,000 before anybody, you know, suffers any kind of new thing. So anybody pretty much going to be protected up to $300,000. That's the biggest one. Is there anything here that you know about? I mean, I know you're an Austrian economist. You stay on top of this stuff.
Well, this is not economics. It's more it's finance. But, you know, the one that gets me is that they just don't permanently correct or index the alternative minimum tax. You know, and that's tagging people well under. I think that hits you. You're at risk if you make a buck and a quarter. It's not that 250. So I mean, you know, they need to fix that too, because you know, an alternative minimum tax is what steps in and just wipes out a lot of your deductions if you happen to get caught in it. So they need to fix that. But you know, I'm always going to say it: they're a bunch of lazy bastards. They fixate on numbers. You know, here's a number, and you know, let's cut it off at that. Let's not look at the type of income it is, like cap gains, deferred interest,
right.
You know, rent, dividend income. They don't look at it that way. They just break it off on a number, and that to me is so aggravating, because in business, there's all sorts of different kinds of income. There's rental income. There's dividends. There's, you know, if you sell it, there's cap gain. They're all different, but they're all income, yet the government steps up and just pounds you at a certain level. It's like, oh, well, okay, so a guy who maybe made, you know, 250 is in, and he made it, it's 250, just playing the market, he's going to get taxed less than a guy who maybe made 250, yet ran a machine shop or something like that, and provided 50 or 60 jobs for, you know, guys that work with their hands, God love them, you know. It just the laziness of it all gets me. But, you know, when you get back to Barack Obama, I'll say it over and over and over, the best thing he has ever done since he was president was commission the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction, you know, the budget, Blue Ribbon Panel, whatever it was called. And they came out with, you know, revenue, tax revenue, and spending cuts, both. You know, let's face it, the deficit is so huge, you gotta deal with it on both ends of the, you know, the input and the output.
Well, and that, you know,
that was his baby, and the Democrats balked at half of it, and the Republicans balked at the other half. I'm sorry, if Barack could throw a set of stones, if they, I put the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission together, do it. You know, and that's what I stand behind. It's this, that was a ballsy proposal, and it would work. It would be painful, but it would work. And nobody's revisiting that. They're all like, oh, well, let's ignore that because that actually spread pain on both sides of the spectrum, you know, both sides of the aisle. Let's not talk about that.
Well, what's really fascinating to me, though, I mean, you mentioned rental income and things like that a second ago. And it reminded me of a story that's out today over at the Courier-Journal by Chris Ottz. And it concerns HSBC, you know, and their foreclosures. Well, we all know now HSBC is Europe's largest bank. They do a ton of business here in the States, okay? But they're the largest banks. They got nailed for money laundering, criminal money laundering. All right, they were moving cash for known terror groups, Mexican drug cartels, and Iran. And the U.S. Department, the U.S. Justice Department, and who has the U.S. Justice Department? Think about it, Ed. All right.
Oh, yeah.
This bonehead holder sits here and lets them off the hook. So they agree to pay a $1.9 billion settlement or fine, and there is going to be no prosecution. Nobody's going to jail. Now, it's extremely strange to me why this is a criminal money laundering case. It's a clear-cut, black-and-white case. Somebody goes to jail in these situations, but miraculously,
I mean, you know,
nobody's going to jail.
You think about it. Your grandma, if she's knitting an afghan, going to the airport, is liable to have to endure more than these guys, you know, because this is terrorist activity. They're facilitating terrorists. I thought we had guys in Whitmo for that crap, you know. But your grandma's going to get her nads fondled because she might be a threat and a terrorist. But Homeland Security can turn a blind eye when some, you know, multi-millionaire executive is flat out laundering money for known terrorist groups, so that, and drug groups, which are practically terrorist groups now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he can launder that money and enable them to buy, you know, whatever they want from China or Russia or hell, from, you know, from somebody boosting it from an American military base. They can load up, they can kill people. Yeah, but this guy walks. I mean, that's a crock.
Oh, I agree. And that's what makes this damn thing so fascinating. HSBC has been one of the leaders in foreclosures. I mean, when you get a foreclosure notice, it usually comes from Bank of New York. Usually HSBC is involved in some way or another because they've got a ton of business even here. You know, and you're looking at all of this and you're thinking, wow, these guys have done so many things wrong. They've crossed every criminal line you could possibly think of, and they're basically getting a fine. Now, you know,
yeah,
let's look at this realistically.
And that is going to come out of the stockholders' butts, you know, because that's going to affect their bottom line, which is going to affect the stockholders. Hell, these clowns up there are probably still getting their full salary and everything.
Well, and it's not going to be much of a bag on surprise to them. HSBC had a net income last year, folks, of $16.8 billion. $16.8 billion. And when HSBC agreed to the settlement, guess what happened? Their stock went up. Their stock went up a half a percent. So
it could have been worse, you know, and that's the thing. And let us not forget that if you're a major bank, you also benefit from, you know, the inflation that's caused. You know, when you get to borrow money for nothing and loan it to everybody else for, you know, if it's credit card for 20-something percent, or if it's a home, you know, 5%. So they're making big bank on it, effectively borrowing money at zero cost from us and loaning it back to us at anywhere from 3 to 20%. And they're funneling money to terrorists and drug groups and helping launder the money. And, yeah, and nobody goes to jail. Hell, they don't even get patted down or cavity searched. I mean, you can get in more trouble for saying the word bomb when you're standing in line at an airport than these guys can for actually contributing to the death of people.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, that's exactly it. And here we've got another situation. Right here in Louisville, Kentucky, HSBC Bank went to court and filed foreclosure on a house on Madison Street in western Louisville. All right? And it was supposed to be sold at a foreclosure auction. So the people that lived there moved. They couldn't keep the house. It was going to be sold at auction, so they just abandoned the property, right? That's what most people would do, right? Except, here's the problem. HSBC never followed through. They never followed through. The problem is that once the house was in foreclosure, the owners left, hadn't lived there for more than a year. The house went into total disrepair. I guarantee you, being in West Louisville, somebody broke in and stole copper pipes and everything else. It's just the way it is. All right? And they've accumulated more than $12,000 in fines for not keeping the property up and unpaid taxes. HSBC is not responsible for this. It's not responsible for this because the owners of the property are the ones who abandoned it when they were told it was going to be sold at auction. HSBC never took ownership of the property. The deeds never changed hands. They never sold the property in a foreclosure. So this lady and her ex-husband at this point, you know, of course, her finances probably had a lot to do with lighter divorce now, okay? But they were not responsible for any of this. So the banks are not on the hook. They can file a foreclosure against you anytime they want to, but until they actually sell that property at a foreclosure sale, you own it. You're responsible for everything. Now, how is that logical?
Well, that's the law. That is the law. And like I say, I tell you, I'm actually going to go with HSBC on this one because literally for next to nothing, I mean, you could get you know, legal aid or anybody. You could look it up online. Until the gavel goes down, you own it. I mean, and that's fairly common knowledge, but it's something they certainly could have found out with just a cursory conversation with a lawyer. Because that's what a lot of people are doing nowadays. I mean, like I said, it's called a strategic foreclosure. It's where people just say, to hell with it, I'm not going to pay it anymore. It's not an attractive deal for me. The house is upside down, whatever. They just stop paying everything.
But here's the rest of that story.
And they live there, and they basically tell the banks, you know, I know some people that have done it, and they just tell the banks, it's like, yeah, you know, start getting your delinquent notices, and they just tear them up, throw them in. It's like, you know what, I'm going to live here until the gavel drops on it. You can go to hell. And they do. And that's, it's called a strategic foreclosure. These people should have looked into it. They got a foreclosure, a delinquent notice. They should have called a lawyer, and a lawyer worth his salt would have said, just stay in the damn house, tell them to go to hell.
Well, but here you're talking about a couple of different things. I mean, immediately there are some holes in that argument for me. Now, I understand the legal aspect of it. I understand you should always consult an attorney. All right? I mean, I'm a victim of an illegal foreclosure on my home. We've talked about that, and I'm still fighting that today, and that's just going to go on. Okay? And that was with Ally, formerly known as GMAC, GMAC, folks. And there's thousands of people out there in the same boat I am that were illegally – they tried an illegal foreclosure. Guess what? I'm still here. But, you know, the reality is, though, in this particular case, after they gave up the property in 2009 because the bank had set a foreclosure sale date for it, and they went ahead and left the house, most people in that situation don't know any better. They really don't, especially when you're talking about the poor. They really don't know any better. Well, lo and behold, what happened was HSBC never followed through on the sale. They canceled the sale, okay? And then in 2010... the owners tried to file bankruptcy and surrender the home just to get rid of it, okay? And then miraculously, in March of 2011, the people who actually held the mortgage, Wells Fargo, decided they didn't want to have a claim on the house anymore. So they gave the former owners the property free and clear, but nobody told them. They had no idea that they still owned this house. They had no idea that they still owned this house, because even when Wells Fargo said, hey, you know what? It's been sitting 2 years vacant. It's in total disrepair. It's not worth it to us to take it back now. We're going to go ahead and give it back to the owners and let them absorb all the responsibility and risk. So the mortgage holders, HSBC, Wells Fargo, people like Ally, GMAC, and the others that go out there and file all these damn foreclosures, start these actions. They don't follow through on them in some cases, but the owners are never notified of that. So they're stuck with a dilapidated property.
I will tell you, the owners, when you get a legal action like that for a significant amount of money, I'm sorry, you need to contact a lawyer.
Okay, but when you're in a situation financially like that, it falls squarely into the
I'm sorry, but that's what you have to do, because
if you can't afford your mortgage, how are you going to afford a lawyer?
For more than you owe, you're entitled to that. You need to know that. You need to know your rights. And like I say, you got to get the right attorney, you know, one with some testicular fortitude, one that could, you know, tell you, look, if it's a losing proposition for you, you know, if you're ready to do it, tell the banks to kiss your ass. And it's time to, it gets to a point, it's like, live there until they kick you out. You know, tell them to go to hell.
The thing is, it ain't fair.
Well, and it doesn't always, banks don't always win. Do a little bit of maintenance on it, but until they sell it on the courthouse steps and the deed changes names, it's yours. They cannot physically remove you from that house. Sit there and live rent-free and tell them to kiss your butt.
I totally get that, and I'm not arguing with that. If you can't afford your mortgage, chances are you're not going to afford an attorney. And free legal aid.
An attorney who will explain the basics to you for $100.
Well, you know what? When you're living in a...
Then potentially, if you get the right attorney, you can live rent-free for the next year and a half, 2 years. That's a hell of a return on investment.
Well, there's no doubt about that. But the after effect right now, to me, is a serious concern. Because the after effect is now that these people who are owners / former owners, depending on how you look at it, now we've had fines and taxes built up on this thing that exceeds $12,000. That they are now obligated to pay for property that they didn't even know that they owned because they voluntarily surrendered it. But the mortgage holder said, oh, no, we don't want the house, so we're not going to accept the house. We'll cancel everything. You get to keep the house after it's been vacant for 2 years because they thought it was sold at auction. You see what I'm saying? I mean, there's a major communication problem here.
This is an amateur. I'm sorry, but it's an amateurish move on their behalf. They took something with a fair amount of money, a fair amount of value, all sorts of legal ramifications from liability insurance forward, and they just kind of did it like I always like to say, like WWE style. They just said, it's yours, and it's like, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's just like selling a car. Somebody can give you $500. You could sell them. You could say, okay, I sold you the car. They can go out and grab it. But you know what? If you don't take the legal responsibilities of transferring the title, and they smash into a van full of kids, guess what? You're going to show up on the list of plaintiffs or whatever. You'll be sued. So,
there's
certain things you have to do, and they failed to do it. And it's not expensive, so I really don't have a lot of sympathy for them.
Who is responsible to notify them, though? Because they were never notified that they still owned the property. They were never notified of any fines, of any taxes, anything. They were never notified of any ownership interest whatsoever.
Apparently they also vacated the premises.
Sure.
Because I can tell you from having known some people who went that route, is that once they start the foreclosure process, there is no shortage of lawyers, you know, those vulture kind. They'll be sending you all sorts of phone calls saying, hey, would you like us to represent you? I mean, they very amateurishly walked away from it, and you just can't.
But they also signed. But again, I guess we're missing a point here. For me, there's another point to be made, and the fact was that they signed the property back over to Wells Fargo. They gave it up, so they did sign the property back over. But they were never informed that Wells Fargo decided not to take the property. So in the meantime, they're not living there. All right. Assumedly, Wells Fargo owns the property now because they did sign a piece of paper giving it back to them. Okay. And at that point, you know, they're free and clear. They don't need an attorney. They voluntarily surrender the property. So in their mind, and this is what I'm getting at. I mean, the general mindset of most people is, once I've done that, I have no further claims anywhere. So instead, the city goes
well,
in, cuts the grass, tries to cut the property.
I agree that on the surface, but the fact of the matter is, when you're doing something with the gravity of signing a home over or something, you spend a couple hundred dollars on an attorney because it's a big move. You get court stamps, you get time stamps, you do that stuff. That's what attorneys are. You know, as much as people may hate them, I'm sorry, but it's a major transaction. You know, you think about how much you got to go through to buy a house, all the 50, 100 times you got to make your initials and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, guy, it's almost, you know, it's not quite as complicated, but that should be an indicator that it's not quite so simple. It's just put your John Hancock down. It's like, all right, well, we're done. It doesn't work.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to let HSBC off the hook and let them pay a paltry $1.9 billion fine for black and white, clear-cut criminal money laundering behavior that somebody should have went to jail for, they certainly could find a way to take care of the homeowners that have been screwed over by people like them. That's my bottom line. I actually wasn't planning on spending that much time on this. I kind of want to get into what's going on in Michigan. And folks, don't forget, you guys are listening to Q. Hit that little number one on your dial pad if you want to be heard on air. For the rest of you guys listening live, 858-683-1326 or 502-805-0334. We're looking at what's going on in Michigan right now. The right-to-work battle. The Republicans on both sides of the Michigan Congress, the State House and the Senate, have basically agreed to right-to-work rules. They slid this thing in immediately. I mean, they did it real quick. Nobody even, you know, had a clue what was going on. But lo and behold, the governor, Governor Snyder, I believe his name is, Governor Rick Snyder, he's not a right-to-work guy, but he said if it comes to his desk, he's going to go ahead and sign it, and it was planned on being signed probably today. I haven't got the latest update on that. It should have been signed either today or tomorrow. Michigan unions are going nuts, predictably, but they're busing union members in from all over the country. They're bringing union members in from all over the country to protest in Michigan. And you know what? I sit here, and I'm thinking, if there's a place that should be right to work right now, I can't think of a better place than Michigan. They've got the fourth highest unemployment in the whole country. This place, Detroit, is literally a ghost town, thanks to the unions and everything else, busting the auto industry up. What is the big deal with right to work? The unions didn't
well,
hear, the
I,
only, go ahead.
Yeah. I think in a lot of cases, you know, when you got a big company like Ford or something and they're spread out, they're unions, and, you know, when you look at the automotive industry, I think that is I don't think they're going to have a problem with right to work. Like Ford does okay with the unions anyway. I mean, you kind of need a union, you know, when you've got tens of thousands of employees, you can't just negotiate rates with each and every one of them. So I think, I think those are right, but I think, as I've always said, you know me, I'm always going to get back to the middle and the small business people,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I think that's really attractive to them. I'll be honest. We're a non-union shop. I don't think the unions could ever get in because we're a very tight-knit bunch. We take good care of our people, and we don't, the executives and the owners don't make quite that much more than the employees, and we work right next to them, but, you know, I think one of the things is small business, because Michigan is learning a painful lesson. Yeah, they've seen a lot of car companies come and go, but you see it when you tie all your hopes and dreams to a couple companies like Ford, GM, and Chrysler. You need small business, and small business is simply not coming to a state that's all that union friendly. Because I can tell you, the mindset of the small businessman is he's doing what he's doing because he wants to be his own boss. And that generally does not mesh real well with, the shop steward telling you how it's going to be. So I think, you know, the cost and everything else, it's small businesses need latitude because they're getting choked off in so many other ways. They certainly don't need to be choked off by their workers. So I think
if you look at this realistically now, you know, I mean, for many, many years, I was against right to work. You know, I'm a strong supporter of the union membership, but I'm not a supporter of union leadership. I've been very clear about that from the very beginning of anything I've ever done. And, you know, when you mentioned Ford as an example, now I can tell you right now, you know, the unions aren't really as powerful as they want everybody to think they are anymore. I mean, if you look at a UAW in Louisville, for example, at Ford, I mean, there are disturbing stories coming out of both plants about the mistreatment of hourly employees and things like that. And the union's like, so what? You know, the union leadership is like, so what? Do your damn job and don't worry about it. I mean, pretty much that's it. So you're paying dues to somebody who basically is sold out and they're not protecting you anyway. And the only thing that people have a problem with right to work just basically means you're going to have a right to work in a union shop and not have to pay any dues. That's it. Now, the union argues, that they've got a legitimate argument here, in my opinion. The union argues that if we're going to bargain, if we're going to do collective bargaining for contractual purposes, and you're going to benefit from that collective bargaining, then you're essentially asking us to work for free. Now, that's a legitimate argument. Can't argue with that. You don't want to work for free. Nobody does. But,
yeah.
But you can't argue the logic. For the reality is that the whole Midwest practically is unionized. The entire South is. We've got 23 states that are fully unionized. Michigan would be 24. And if you look at the ones involved, you're looking at everything from Texas to the Carolinas, from Texas straight up to the Dakotas, and half
not
of the West.
Kentucky.
Not Kentucky, I understand. But half of the West. You know, Indiana is even right to work now. They put it in effect last year. And when we look at this, so what the proponents, what the unions try to say is that the right to work kills wages, that it doesn't increase jobs or anything else. And then I have to sit back and I have to realize we've got Toyota in Kentucky. When you talk about the automobile market, the only difference between Toyota, a non-union automaker, and Ford, a union automaker, essentially cost-wise, are the legacy costs of retirees. Toyota just simply hasn't been around long enough to have the legacy cost of retirees that Ford does, thanks to those union contracts. Now, those same unions, the UAW, gave up those cushy retirement benefits for anybody that's now new hires that have been hired into this contract. All the new hires don't have those cushy terms that all the other employees did. So even the UAW gave up on
them. They don't make very good money either, to be real honest.
Well, you know, Toyota makes about the same as Ford workers do. Their benefits are about the same. So, you know, from that aspect, things have been pretty good. The people who aren't making good money now are the new hires. The new hires are making $15 an hour.
They're not making it very well, no.
No, they're making $15 an hour to sell their body. They're selling their body cheaper than ever. But that's exactly what you're doing in that kind of situation. But this right to work is starting to get interesting because I'm starting to understand more and more why so many people are upset. But what I don't understand is the union thuggery. I mean, we've got reports of fights and everything else breaking out in Michigan right now because the union thugs are showing up and they're getting angry at people who are protesting in favor of right to work. So they're not respecting their freedom. You know what I mean? And that's the problem.
Yeah,
that's what union leadership promotes.
Yeah.
And that's what union leadership promotes. So when I look at right to work, I'm really to the point anymore where I'm sick of the union leadership. They are the ones who have destroyed labor. And when it gets right down to it, do you know what the percentage of union workers is in America today?
I think last it was like 13% or something. And it's even lower than that when you back out the government employees. It's in the single digits.
It's roughly about 7% in the private sector, and it's about 11% when you include the government employees. Now, when you look at that in play, 7% of the population is unionized. 93% is not. What's the problem, folks? What's the problem? And you want to know what right to work does for you? You want to know what happens when you don't have a lot of unions? All right. They just had a report put out of the top 10 cities in America for jobs when it comes to unemployment. You know where they're at? North, baby.
The work states, baby.
Bismarck, North Dakota, the number one city where everybody works. Their unemployment rate, 2.2%, right-to-work state. Fargo, North Dakota, unemployment rate, 2.8%, right-to-work state. And before anybody talks about wages, the median household income in Bismarck is $58,000, and Fargo is $53,000. All right? Grand Forks, North Dakota. That's where I came from when I was in the military. I spent my time up there. And believe me, those people there work. And they're at 3.1%. Lincoln, Nebraska, 3.2%. Texas, 3.3%. Ames, Iowa, 3.4%. I can go on and on and on. South Dakota, Vermont, Idaho. These are the places, folks. The right-to-work states, and they've got the lowest unemployment in the nation. Now, what does that tell us?
There's no way you can get to that kind of unemployment without small and medium-sized business. And right-to-work, man, my father used to always, you know, he would always say, going back 30 years, if Kentucky needs the right-to-work law, Kentucky needs the right-to-work law. Now, they keep calling me at work, hey, you want to donate? Like, no. No, thanks. But to me, when you're a right-to-work state, and I look at Indiana sometimes and think, yeah, and let them piss me off too much in Kentucky. It's only across the river, dude. But I think it just puts it, as I've seen on this trip I'm on, it's a way of putting a sign up saying we're open for business. Not so much big business that, you know, it's still compatible with union membership, but small and medium-sized business, which is not really all that compatible with union membership. It's saying, look, you know, a union can't come in and take your shop over. It just doesn't work that way in this state. So they don't come in here without fear of, you know, as you say, the thugs coming in and telling you how to run your business for which you mortgaged your house and everything else to start. And I think that's the key. It's always 70% of the jobs are small business, so you can't get to those kind of unemployment numbers without small business. And right to work says to small business, we're open for business. That's about what it says.
Well, that's exactly it. And then you got to look at the other factor here, too. I mean, you know, yeah, we're open for business. A small business is the key and leads the way. But, you know, let's look at the unions themselves. The unions themselves will eat their brothers and sisters up like fries on, you know, steak on poop or something. Because let's look at what the UAW union did to the Teamsters. Let's look at Ford did. The trucking, the guys who drive the vehicles, the new vehicles and everything else, had always been Teamster employees. Ford decided when they retooled LAP here in Louisville that they were going to eliminate the Teamsters. Now they're using private trucking, you know, this non-union labor, and the UAW workers go to work every day. So they didn't stand in solidarity with the Teamsters, you know. And you can find examples like that all over the country. You know, the unions themselves don't care. The Teamsters care about the Teamsters. The UAW cares about the UAW. The UFCW cares about the UFCW. They don't intermingle. They don't stand in solidarity with anybody else. Look at what Ford was able to do. What was it? Delphi? Delphi lost all of their pensions.
Yeah,
they lost all of their pensions. They lost all of their people. You know, GM goes into bankruptcy. They say, see you later. Screw you. We're going to keep our unions. We're exempt. The unions got to keep all of their pensions and everything else. But everybody else that was non-union lost it all because the government said so. Obama said so. Reelect me. I mean, that's the strategy, and that's the problem. The union doesn't stand in solidarity with anybody. The union leadership doesn't even stand in solidarity with the people they purport to represent. That's the major hang-up. That's why unions are on their way out.
Yeah, they're in survival mode, and, you know, it's first thing to go, I guess, is that unity and ideology.
Well, you know, the unions today are just like Mitch McConnell up on the hill, man. That's the bottom line. They want to live by an old set of rules. They can't understand why they're losing favor, but they don't give a crap. They're going to draw the circle of the wagons and draw their arms and sit back and let nature take its course. They're a bunch of idiots. Final thoughts, Ed. We're on the end of the game, baby.
Hey, well, you know what? First final thought is, damn, AT&T has great coverage because I have been driving through the mountains of West Virginia and only cut out for a few seconds. So, you know what? Salute to them. I'm impressed. I fully figured to be dropped at some point. But, you know, like I said, it's everything is theater now. And that's why I think they keep things vague. It's because, you know, it's all surface veneering and stuff. Whether Boehner's talking to Barack in any meaningful way, you know, theater. Whether the Republicans in the state and the city and Mitch McConnell are trying to control their, you know, candidates so they get a certain look and a certain demeanor. Theater, you know what? And we don't need theater. We need good people that can get down, get dirty, get innovative, and get things fixed, because we're still in trouble. Things are rolling along okay right now, but we are on very shaky ground. We need to get a lot of stuff fixed, because there's still a lot of debt rolling up on our kids, and that's always going to be there until we actually start fixing some stuff.
Well, you know, and I'm going to step in. By the way, AT&T has gotten a lot better. My wife used to be with them, and if we traveled outside of Louisville, we couldn't get signal most of the time. So I'm glad to hear they're getting better, because competition is what we need to keep the rates down. So that's good. Yeah. But when we look at everything going on in the nation today, when we look at the unemployment figures, when we look at the unions versus non-union, we look at right to work, you know, we look at the foreclosure mess, we look at criminal money laundering is now acceptable in America, I can't help but say, guess what, folks? Welcome to liberalism. And I tell you why. Because, you know, we're now bragging today about how we've got all of these brand new jobs. Unemployment's going down because we've created all these jobs. The problem is the private sector isn't creating the jobs. 73% of all jobs created over the last 5 months were what? Government jobs. The government is the biggest union in America today. So now, as a payback by the Democrats, we're going to increase the size of government. We're going to fill government jobs. We're going to make 73% of all new jobs government jobs, with full retirement, full pensions, great pay, and oh, by the way, you're locked in for life. Welcome to the union. Elect a Democrat. And at the same time, we're broke. We're broke. We have got to find a way to bring the private sector back into the jobs game. We've got to find a way to bring small business, kick the crap out of small businesses' ass. Take the handcuffs off of these boys and watch them run. Because that's where we're going to have a future at. We can no longer continue creating McDonald's jobs for those employees to walk across the street and spend their money at Burger King. That's not a good lifestyle, folks. And that's where we are. When most of the jobs that we create in this country are government jobs that are protected by unionism and protected by increased taxes.
Or part-time jobs where the government has to subsidize the employees.
Oh, yeah. You know, and when we look at all of these things, almost 50%, one out of every two people, as I mentioned last night, look around you. One out of every two people you see is probably receiving a government subsidy. Almost 50% of the people are receiving government assistance in some form or another. That's ridiculous. And I have to ask myself, if President Obama had an R after his name instead of a D, will we still be okay with these results? Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. A Republican would be lambasted, raked over the coals, and shot on sight if they had the same dismal economy that we have today. The media would go crazy having a field day with pointing out the obvious. Liberalism in America is failing. We can't go straight to socialism. That's where we're going. It has failed throughout history and every nation on earth. It is failing now in the United States of America, once the greatest nation in the world. We're going to find out what the future brings pretty daggone quick, because that fiscal cliff is approaching. And when it gets here, God help us all. That's all I got to say.
Yeah,
that's it for tonight.
There's going to be some fun shows when it gets here. Yeah.
Ain't no doubt about it. That's it for tonight. Mr. Martin, be safe, my friend. All right?
All right, sir.
All right, brother. I appreciate you joining us on the road.
God willing and the creek don't rise. I'll see you on Monday.
Yes, sir. Take care. Be safe.
All right, sir.
All right. For the rest of you guys, we appreciate you listening in. Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, as usual, Dale the Truth with the TNT. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm here tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, I will be here with Dale the Truth at 7 o'clock. We're getting into some of the national issues, and you're gonna love Dale Gillespie. I guarantee your right to work is going to come up. So we'll get into that tomorrow night. Thursday night at 7, TNT show with Dale the Truth Gillespie. And Sunday night at 7, Liberty Unbridled with our good friend, Libertarian Ken Molman. In the meantime, folks, have a great night. Thanks for listening. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Take care.